Hello, Brooklyn, how you doing? G, where you going? We cannot come to. And if I can, I'm gonna be your man. You can be my lady and have my baby and drive my car. You got me crazy. So crazy. However you going, baby, where you going? Just take me, cause I'm so taken. Hello, Nets fans. How you doing? This is the Russell and Fro podcast with Russell here and Fro there. I am Brett the Man Bun Garofalo, digitally tethered to my co-host and confidant, Carl the Talent Jackson. Nets fans, we did it. We survived one of the most tumultuous, career-altering, ACL-popping regular seasons imaginable and have arrived at the 2021 postseason with a healthy Nets squad. All players on the Brooklyn Nets are now allowed to drink water while the sun is up. What a win. What a wild ride, folks. So much exciting Nets talk coming. But first, stop the presses and listen intently as we ask. Carl, how are things in your world?
Brett, I'm good. The sun is shining here in Vermont. It's starting to smell like summertime, which smells a little bit like cow shit and a little bit like weed. And it's just very nice outside. Very nice. I had my first day of thinking, this is uncomfortably hot out, and that usually doesn't happen until like July. So I'll take it, and I'm ready to go. And it's playoff basketball is in the air, and it's not just the cow shit because I'm watching the Pacers Wizards game.
Be careful about mentioning cow shit and weed in the same sentence. We don't want the Ben and Jerry's guys to get an idea for a new flavor.
I mean, listen, they're familiar with it. Let me tell you. I'm pumped, man. Here we are. Like this is it. This is what we came to see here. This is the postseason. This is what this team has been building towards since before the James Harden deal. I don't know if you saw, but it was announced today that James Harden will be paying for half the ticket price of like a bunch of Nets fans that are going in the vaccinated section. The fact that getting into Barclays was enough of a boondoggle just already. Like when I would go to the series against like the Raptors with that 2014 team, during the playoffs, like I cannot imagine going to games now as this, start of the playoffs is coinciding with the complete reopening of the world essentially. And everybody's fumbling in the dark, like a bunch of teenagers, you know, playing seven seconds in heaven, trying to figure out like how this is supposed to work. So, that should be interesting, but hopefully with the boost from Harden and the hunger from the Nets fans, like we'll get some good crowds into Barclays to make some serious noise, get the Brooklyn Brigade in there, and it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun. Let's buckle up. Let's enjoy the ride.
I mean, not only have some of these people not been outside in a year, they have not been around other people in a year too. So going into a sporting arena and trying to make noise at the appropriate time and not saying things that may be inappropriate in public, I mean, we could be in for some of the most raucous crowds that we've ever seen. And this really is, now that you're making me think about it, a postseason 2 years in the making, from that first moment of excitement to many, 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 many ups and downs, from Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant signing to this first game kicking off at 7 p.m. Central Time, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, coming on Saturday. I cannot wait for it. And I think that's a good dovetail into what we wanted to start off with, which is the Nets are going to have bandwagon fans for the playoffs. This is awesome. We are very excited to have you. So first of all, if you're listening to this podcast and you're looking to learn a little about the Nets going into the postseason, welcome. We're happy to have you. There's soda. There's beer in the fridge. DeAndre Jordan's in the kitchen making vegan pancakes. They should be ready in about 10 minutes if you're hungry. He's not going to be playing, so don't worry about it. If he gets burned or, if he's drinking in there, he's going to be on the bench. He's more of a coach at this point. But I think a good question to start off with would be, and maybe Carl, I'll push it back to you. If you're a fan coming into this thing, and you're looking to learn more about the Brooklyn Nets and sound a little bit more informed at the first playoff watching party that you might be going to in a while, what are some underrated aspects of the Nets that you would want to point out to the more casual fan or somebody that's, maybe hopping over from the Pelicans or the Orlando Magic?
So I'll get to that in one second. I do just want to say, if you are listening or wondering what we're going to be talking about, we're going to do our usual where we just yammer back and forth for like an hour and a half, maybe. The kind of theme here, I think, is key questions for the playoffs. So Brett's is the first. If you are walking in, like, what's something that, as we've been watching this team all year, that we would want you to know about them. For me, and I think we did a similar question like this an episode or two ago, and I think I said how much of a team this is, and looking at the contributions from the end of the bench from guys like Bruce Brown. You know, we have seen, you know, in addition to KD, Kyrie, and James Harden, and the now since departed Caris LeVert, you know, we have seen this team be led in scoring by Joe Harris, Jeff Green, Landry Shamet, Alize Johnson. So like it's really been a deep effort. So on that theme, I think to me, one of the most fun things has been watching kind of the narrative machine, the take-a-pede, as Jason Concepcion calls it on what is NBA Desktop called now? I forget. It's not No Dunks. Oh man, no. Totally blanking. You can look it up. I'll continue. That you know, basically you can tell the Nick Wrights of the world, who've sort of just staked out their position as anti-Nets from the beginning, have really had to cycle through a lot of different storylines here. And I think, you know, it started from the beginning with kind of this idea like, okay, if you're going to throw this team together on the fly, like the personalities aren't going to match, the players aren't going to get along. And I think what we have seen, both in terms of the way that they've complemented themselves on the basketball court and the way that they've complemented themselves as personalities, is not only have they gotten along, like I really feel like there's been an additive multiplicative effect putting these guys together. And specifically, I mean, when I just think of the way that I understand Kyrie Irving's game and the way that I understand James Harden's game, like I've gained a whole new appreciation for both of them just by understanding that, you know, Harden is a creator and is a point guard, and Kyrie is, you know, point guard size, but is really a shooting guard. And, you know, understanding sort of those two lanes for them to be in has been incredible. So I just think, you know, for all the jokes about like, oh, there's only one ball, how are they going to coexist? Like, not only are they coexisting, but they're really making each other better. And you can tell when one of them is not there, like specifically what they miss from them, whether it's, you know, Harden's ability to set the offense up, to run things, to just be an absolute genius level creator. And Alex Schiffer had a great article in The Athletic today just about like how quickly his mind works, how he picks things up and is such a fast study of the game, and how that's helped him coming into a new situation. And I feel like that's something that you sort of don't think of a lot with him, or people have been a little bit maybe underplayed in their analysis of what he brings to the game. But like, he is just truly, truly like on a next level in terms of thinking the game. So you know, him kind of bringing that to the team, KD being just the best superstar amplifier that we've ever seen, and Kyrie being a ceiling raiser in the vein of Steph Curry, albeit with a different game. I think, you know, thinking of him in that way as somebody who, when, you know, a team is doing everything perfectly on the defensive end to shut you down, can just get loose no matter what, because he's the most skilled player of all time. Like there's a real sense of order in the way that they're all put together. And I think that's something that, you know, for all the cliches about the team being thrown together, about the, you know, the guys know each other enough, or can they build enough chemistry, blah, 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 blah. Like it's really, really worked really, really well. And seems very purpose built and very much like, you know, the role players that are around them are there very much on purpose. So that's the thing that I would point out to anybody, particularly because it goes a little bit against the grain of the sort of prevailing wisdom on this team.
I think that's spot on. The things that I was going to bring up seem like sub bullet points under the umbrella of what you were saying. Folks are going to be very surprised when they turn on a Nets game, have only heard the narrative of there's only one ball, have only seen this Nets team play with just Kyrie Irving, just Kevin Durant, just James Harden, or two of the three, if they were lucky, throughout the regular season, put it on with all three of them and say, oh, wow, how is this going to work? Only to watch the Nets pass it five or six times on one possession to find an open corner three for Bruce Brown, who knocks it down, or Landry Shamet to be our leading scorer and go 7 of 8 from three and win us a couple of playoff games. Those are going to be the moments that really surprise folks and turn the public's perception and really get them to believe in this Nets team, versus looking at this conglomeration of stars starting off by hating us and actively rooting against us. I feel like the way that the Nets play could actually turn some people and get them on our side by the end of the postseason. And, you know, hey, maybe that's, you know, maybe that's looking at it with rose-colored glasses, but the Nets play the game the right way, even if it was an artificially created team. And I think it's going to be a very enjoyable brand of basketball to watch, and folks are going to be surprised by how much they enjoy watching the Nets. And they might even find themselves organically rooting for this team. Also, Jason Concepcion's show is called All Caps. Took me longer to all find caps. That than
that's,
I thought,
that's what
but
it
it's
is.
All caps.
Our apologies there. I think it's funny because, like, I think when you have, I mean, when you had KD and Kyrie and like Caris LeVert or Spencer Dinwiddie as kind of that in that third slot, you know, it did devolve a little bit, maybe less with Dinwiddie at the beginning of this season, but it did devolve a little bit into sort of your turn, my turn a little bit more. But I feel like adding Harden into that mix, like even though he's a bigger star and even though he's somebody that's, you know, gotten famous for pushing the envelope in terms of what a heliocentric kind of offensive creator can be, like he is really like holds everything together offensively in a way that brings it to that sort of beautiful game Spurs or, you know, early Warriors type of just aesthetically pleasing basketball. So I'm excited for them to get more minutes together and really come to life.
Well, and there's one stat that's a leading indicator of the Nets brand of basketball and how different it is than folks might expect. And a lot of that starts and ends with James Harden, like you mentioned. And if you're going to look at what people hate about his game, which is how many free throw attempts that he takes per game, how often he gets to the line, he's still taking the same amount of attempts per game, but the percentage of attempts that he's taking per minute is down. And the way that he's drawing those fouls is not in the same way that he was drawing them in Houston. They're much more off of drives versus sticking his legs out on three-pointers or pulling some of those what you would call cheapo fouls. And it even seems like when watching him, and this is going to sound like a homer comment, I realize what I'm saying, but he's not getting the same type of calls that he was getting in Houston. He has to work harder to get those fouls, which is why he's getting those on drives. And I think that's another thing which makes the Nets style of basketball a lot more aesthetically pleasing than Harden's former teams, because he's still that offensive fulcrum. It's just a little bit different how he's getting to those same outlets and avenues for points.
Yeah, it's another thing that I think playoff proofs the team a little bit more as well. You know, both I think when you look at what their fourth quarter offense has been this season, the fact that, you know, when you don't necessarily have the ability to run an action or run a play, but, you know, you can isolate from three different spots on the court, like the fact that that is so sort of defense proof and scheme proof, and the fact that they're not relying on those free throws. I mean, that was something that on the Simmons and Russillo pod, like, you know, Ryan Russillo mentioned, because, you know, which indicated to me that he's just not paying attention, that, like, you know, oh, like once Harden gets in the playoffs, like the fouls like won't be officiated the same way. But he's not, I mean, you know, I guess he is drawing fouls, but he's drawing them, to your point, in a much different way. And it doesn't seem like the kind of thing that won't be sustainable in the postseason. So, but I guess with that, let me move on to my next key question, Brett. It's very serious. And it involves our playoff matchup, which we learned after the result of the first play-in game on Tuesday. The Nets will be playing the Boston Celtics. And I don't know if you recall, I know that you're, you know, pretty plugged in as a Nets fan, maybe more than most, but the Nets and the Celtics actually made a trade a few years ago, maybe 2014, which brought Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett to the Brooklyn Nets, along with Jason Terry. Actually, I always forget that he was involved there. A bunch of stuff. Gerald Wallace, Chris Humphreys went to Boston, along with quite a few draft picks, Brett. I don't know if that was ever mentioned. Doom and gloom was forecast for the Nets. And, you know, it was thought to be a hole that they would never dig themselves out of. And yet here we are. The two teams meet in the postseason. The Nets are the two seed. The Celtics are the seven. Can we officially say that the Nets have won this trade, Brett?
100% without question, the Nets won this trade. Fuck you, Celtics fans. Eat shit, Danny Ainge. You lost. Deal with it. We fleece Trader Janny. End of story. Okay, no, just kidding. Like the real answer is absolutely not. We got fleeced in that trade. We got fleeced in that trade. The Celtics are going to have somewhere between 15 and 20 straight postseason appearances because of that trade for Pierce and Garnett. They're already on 7. They are on 7 postseason appearances in a row since that trade, which includes 4 second round exits and 3 conference finals exits. Oh, and also Jason Tatum just turned 23 this year, and Jaylen Brown is turning 25 later this year in October. So, I mean, these guys are just going to be making the postseason forever. If they don't win a chip, okay, great, but that is a pretty damn good trade-off for players that took us to the second round, and really only one of those players significantly contributed to that second round exit, where the Nets won 1 game against the eventual champion Miami Heat. And hell, I'm really not kidding about that 20 straight postseason appearances in a row that they can make there. I mean, like, listen, they'd have to get really lucky with the injury bug. I mean, they still made it this year with Jaylen Brown going down. They'd have to get some cost-controlled players, but holy crap. I'm really just hoping that whatever success the Nets have this year and over the next 3 or 4 years gets everybody to mention this freaking trade just a little bit less. We lost the trade. It sucked. We somehow now have 3 superstars. We are heavily favored in this series with the Celtics, who fleeced us in that trade. They might not win a game in this series. So let's enjoy it, and let's not let the Pierce and Garnett talk drag us down. End rant.
So, okay, a couple things. Number one, that team won 1 game against the Miami Heat, but I was at that game, so that was pretty cool. It was a pretty fun game. It was fun little trivia fact. It was game 3 of that series. And it was the game. There is a meme picture of Jay-Z and Beyonce where, like, Jay-Z is sort of sitting back looking bored and exasperated. Beyonce is leaning forward talking to Jake Gyllenhaal, who is on his right. That was taken at that game. Jason Sudeikis was also there, for those of you who are Ted Lasso fans. So a lot of fun. Enjoyed it. The other piece of trivia that I would say, you said only one player contributed. That was Paul Pierce, I'm assuming.
Absolutely.
Kevin Garnett was Paul Pierce contributed, but then walked in free agency that summer. Mm. Kevin Garnett, I don't know if you recall, stayed the next year and was traded to Minnesota, essentially to allow him to retire for Thaddeus Young, who came to Brooklyn, gave a few very good years, and then was traded for the draft pick that became either, I believe, Jared Allen. I'm pretty sure it was Jared Allen. It was either Jared Allen or Caris LeVert. But in any event, that player, whichever one of them it was then traded for James Harden. So ipso facto, maybe the Nets did win that trade. I agree with you. I think you're right. It was a joke question. The one thing that I would say is, if you're a Nets fan and you're mad about it, which it sounds like you were, Brett, I would argue you're not mad at the trade itself, right? It was a bad trade made for bad reasons by a front office that cared more about fulfilling sort of marketing aims of the organization than fielding a championship basketball team at that point. There's nothing wrong with saying that was a bad trade. I see some folks on Twitter trying to act like, oh, no, it wasn't. That's wrong. Don't belittle the work that John Marks has done by acting like that trade wasn't a complete disaster. What you're mad at, though, and what you have a right to be mad at, I think, is, you know, I came up with this super convoluted metaphor about, like, buying a new refrigerator that I think is too convoluted to explain here. But it's like if I buy something from you, Brett, and I pay you $100 more than I should have, I have overpaid. I have lost that transaction in effect, right? But I've only overspent it by $100, which, like, you know, if I'm buying your car or something like that, like $100 maybe isn't a big deal. Maybe it is, but it's a finite amount, right? So I think that when you look at this trade too, it's like they gave up draft picks for 4 years. That's what they gave up. That doesn't mean that they created a hole for themselves that no franchise could ever climb out of. That doesn't mean that they created a hole for themselves that they themselves couldn't climb out of. They were able to get back to the postseason in 4 years. I think the discussion around this trade, because there is a natural event that happens every year in June where the Nets, which is the draft, where the Nets did not have a pick, and it comes up as, like, hilarious, here's a joke, the Nets suck, blah, blah, blah. You know, creates this smokescreen where you don't really see what they were doing and what they were building behind the scenes. So be mad at the discussion around the trade and be mad at the inability to quantify the impact or the risk of the trade, even if we can all agree that the trade was bad.
Absolutely. I'm mad at the frequency with which the trade gets brought up in any discussion about the Nets, especially when it's a discussion with somebody that is not a fan of the Nets, and how much the trade still gets brought up by the national media. And I could not be more excited for this franchise to be defined by something other than that trade, which I'm hoping is a championship in the next 1 to 3 years. And also, on a similar vein, I don't want to hear any more about this bridge. It was a good bridge. I thought it was that value. You've gotten years of use out of it. Stop bringing it up.
Still cold. Keeps my beers cold.
Absolutely.
That's all you can ask. All right.
Well, I think that's enough of that. Those are some good hot and cold topics to start the podcast off on. And now I think we can go into the real meat and potatoes portion of the playoff questions that have been eating away at us. And now that the play-in has shaken out, at least for the two seeds, we're recording this on Thursday night when the eighth seed is going to be determined, and it's looking like it's going to be the Washington Wizards. They're winning by about 40 points right now, and we'll see who the Jazz are going to play. But we know that the Brooklyn Nets will be facing off against the Boston Celtics, as we've discussed. And since we have our opponent, I'm interested to hear from you, Carl. We're playing the Celtics, but out of the four teams that were potential threats to play the Nets as the seventh seed, the Hornets, the Pacers, the Wizards, and the Celtics, who would you have preferred to play the most? And then in turn, who would you have preferred to play the least out of those four teams?
So initially, before I sort of thought about the trade stuff, like, the storylines with Washington and Russell Westbrook playing, squaring off against Durant and Harden, and no mention of Jeff Green, which I'm already fired up for the omission there, even though it's a counterfactual and it won't happen. I think that would have been annoying. The Wizards scared me a little bit just because the Nets actually played them quite poorly in the regular season, and they're a team that scores so well. I'm a little bit more scared for the Nets of teams that score really well. Because I feel like if they were playing Atlanta, for instance, or Washington, you know, I feel like those teams generally get into track meets and outscore their opponents. And the Nets don't really have a good counter for that. Aside from the fact that they can just outscore them back. So like in one way, like it sort of plays into the Nets' hands because it's exactly what they want to do. But on the other way, like I feel like when they play stronger defensive teams, like, they can kind of scramble them a little bit because they're able to score in ways that their defense can't account for. So I was a little bit wary of Washington. If Gordon Hayward was out, I might have said Charlotte or Indiana. I mean, looking at the numbers, though, from this season, and obviously it's a small sample size, it's three games for each, like, the Celtics is maybe my answer. Like, I think a couple reasons. So on the year, the Nets had a plus 16.5 net rating against Boston, which is their best against any of the playoff opponents that they will face in the East, frankly. They had a 119 offensive rating, which was, 118.9 offensive rating, which was second only to their offensive rating against the Knicks and the Hawks. So that's pretty good. They had a 102.3 defensive rating, which was their best against any of the playoff opponents overall. The only metric where I would be a little bit concerned is their defensive rebound percentage was 65, which is pretty low. That is an area of concern, I think, given that I don't think they'll want to play DeAndre Jordan. Tristan Thompson is like the guy that I think of just because of what he was able to do with that first LeBron team that played the Warriors in the finals, pounding the offensive glass. But I felt like they were going to do that in the third meeting that they played, and he just really, really didn't make that much of an impact. I just felt like all of those games were pretty, pretty in control. I secretly think, and listen, I mentioned this on Twitter today, like, to do a brief quick digression, like, as somebody who is a huge Kemba Walker fan and will be for life, and I love the guy, I hate that Kyrie's exit from Boston and Kemba's entrance there have created these two sort of straw man versions of each of them that Celtics fans hold up as like, oh, Kemba is like this glorious person, which I do think he is, but isn't the point. And Kyrie is like this terrible person, which I don't think he is. I think that's wrong. Like, I think you can like the Nets, you can like Kyrie, you can dislike the Celtics, frankly, and still like Kemba Walker. I do it every day. I do think that Kemba presents an opportunity for Brooklyn because he is somebody that Kyrie can match up well from a defensive standpoint, right? Kyrie's liability on the defensive end is a lot related to his height, his length. Kemba is somebody that he, you know, Kyrie has the athleticism to sort of stick with and stay in front of. Smaller guard, so like there's no possibility of really like taking advantage of him by shooting over him or backing him down. So I feel like it's like hubris to say Boston, but I the numbers have kind of talked me into it, especially with Jaylen Brown out, who I think was just having such a great season. You know, I fear Tatum. I respect Tatum. Like what Tatum did against Washington on Tuesday night, like would have, you know, could have easily won a game against the Nets too. Like he was just outrageous. So there's a little bit of that factor. I think you had that with Beal. You maybe wouldn't have had that with Indiana or Charlotte, but I don't know, man. The more I just look kind of up and down at the stats and the matchups and think back to the games this year, like I'm really not upset to be playing Boston.
You and I disagree here, and I'm very excited about this because it's rare that we disagree on this level. I'm gonna get into that in a second, but I do agree with your Wizards take. Looking at the scores from the season, I wanted to remind myself because they did play so many close games. I didn't realize that we lost two out of the three games that we played with them. I just remembered them all being very close. First one, 123-122 loss on January 3rd. Then we also lost again in January on the 31st, 149-146. That's an insane offensive game. And then we finally beat them in March, 113-106. So those were all close battles down to the wire. That would have been a really, really fun series, but volatile, like you said. And you get a couple good Westbrook games where he actually connects from downtown, and who knows what happens. I don't think they're going to beat us in the series, but tire us out, take us to six. Who the heck knows? I had, and I'll start with the boring part of my answer, the team I wanted to play the least was the Hornets due to them having no Hayward, who I really thought elevated that team with his playmaking and passing in a way that was very underrated. Devontae Graham, Terry Rozier, they're score first point guards. And Hayward was almost their de facto second point guard once LaMelo got going, and taking that second level of playmaking ability out of their starting lineup, I think, really hurt them. They're also having a nightmare regression season from Devontae Graham after he was in consideration for most improved player. Then LaMelo is still a rookie. He might be a star, might be a superstar. He's looking like he's on that trajectory, but he's still only a rookie and has a lot to learn. I think this is a guaranteed four-game sweep if they had somehow made it through. But that being said, that is also probably why they got blown out by a Pacers team missing three out of its five best players. So case in point.
And you meant they were the team you wanted to play the most, right?
That was the team I wanted to play the most. My bad.
Cool. That's what I thought.
The team that I wanted to play the least is the Celtics. And here's why. I think in the playoffs, two things shine through. One is coaching and the other is talent, of course. Not saying anything out of the ordinary there. I think that the Celtics have the best coach and the best player out of all four teams in the play-in. That being Jason Tatum, that's an obvious one. Come at me, Bradley Beal. Both of them have a track record of proven playoff success. I think if you remember Jason Tatum at the age of, good Lord, this has been said so many times, it's a meme, but he was probably 11, maybe 9 years old in 2017 when he and Brad Stevens took the 2017 Cavs to seven games in the Eastern Conference Finals. I think that if we're looking at worst case scenario in this series, there's no way the Nets are losing this series. And if it goes past five, I will be shocked. But what I could see happening is Stevens is a very good coach. He just doesn't have the personnel this year. He takes a look at the Nets. He schemes up some stuff that might slow us down a little bit, might work a little bit, might throw a couple wrinkles that the Nets are having trouble reacting to. And in turn, better coaches, or at least coaches that have better personnel, take a look at what Stevens did and can say, you know what? I hadn't thought of that. Maybe I can use that effectively against the Nets. And, oh, by the way, I have significantly more talent, or at least more healthy talent, than Brad Stevens does. And I'm going to do that and see if it has enough of an effect on the Nets offense that we can win against them. Now, the flip side of that is, okay, maybe that whips the Nets into shape. Nash, the coaching staff, the players, hell, I mean, they haven't played together in a long, long time, and they need to be tested a little bit and be able to play through these growing pains and play through these bumps and really figure it out in a higher pressure situation, especially Nash as a first-time playoff head coach. And it could end up being really good for them, but I do worry about the potential ripple effects of Stevens uncovering a few things that he might have been saving for the postseason.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I do definitely, you know, understand the point about kind of, you know, Stevens as a tactician, and I understand the point about the Celtics having the playoff experience. I think that's very fair. But I don't know. I just feel like matchup wise, it's not, you know, they guard well, but like even like you know, I just feel like a lot of the advantages that you would expect them to have, whether it's Marcus Smart's defensive ability, are just things that the Nets probably won't struggle with quite as much. Like I don't hate that matchup for Harden, even though, you know, like, cause they're both just kind of similar in terms of like being sort of stout, you know, thick boys out there. You know, like, so I'm just not quite as worried about it. I would be if they had shown something in the regular season previously. I just felt like in all of those meetings and none of which came with the Nets having all three of the big three playing either PS. I just felt like in none of those did they really, really ever take advantage of it fully. I think they've had their own struggles just to get things pulled together on their side, which, you know, on the one hand, like, those could just go away and they could have a really good series. You know, I do think you could get a Tatum game. I do think you could get a Walker game. Like, it wouldn't be insane to me if it went to like six. I mean, like, I would be surprised if it did, but it could happen. I could definitely see how it would. I don't know. I just think matchup wise, like, there isn't anybody on that team that scares me in the way, in terms of like strength on a deficiency for the Nets, that really, really concerns me. If their front line was a little bit better, you know, I know Time Lords had a great sort of emergence this season, and, you know, Tristan Thompson can muck it up inside, but, you know, I feel like that's even something that, like, DeAndre is a counter for that for Tristan Thompson is fine, and, you know, Claxton and Time Lord like playing together, like, that doesn't really bother me. You know, losing Brown, I think, obviously, you know, hurts their frontline depth. I feel like you'll be able to play Blake. I feel like you'll be able to play Jeff Green. I'm not as worried about it as I am a team like obviously the teams that we'll face in the later rounds, which were omitted from your question. But I don't know, just even like trying to contain Russ or Beal, trying to, you know, I'm probably overrating like Charlotte or Indiana, and given that Hayward's injured, like those were probably the better picks. I don't know. I just didn't feel like they were as realistic an opponent. But to me, it was really just in that game, like between Washington and Boston, I would rather have faced Boston by a large percentage.
And well, hey, maybe I was thinking about the question a little bit differently the way that I phrased it too. It's not like I'm thinking the Celtics are the toughest opponent that we're going to face. It was more thinking about the potential fallout of Stevens getting super creative and doing something weird that other teams could learn from. And I guess that wasn't the real spirit of the question, but that's where my mind went to when I was thinking through this. It's like, what could be the potential worst effect outside of injuries that could come out of this first round? And that was the scariest thing that I could come up with, because I didn't see any of the four teams having a shot in hell to put together a competitive series with the Nets. So I see what you're saying there. Side question though, are we going to get Tristan Thompson one last good NBA contract? I mean, dude might average like 5 or 6 offensive rebounds a game in this series.
I mean, if there's any team that can do it, I suppose it would be the Nets. Right? Hopefully not.
LeBron's friends get paid, Carl.
Do you remember when we did that rebounding podcast about the Kardashians and like Blake and Tristan Thompson were very prominently featured? I've forgotten which Kardashian is assigned to which, but I remember that they liked rebounders.
Well, that's probably why they're not dating any of the Nets.
Yeah, exactly. Reggie Evans. Reggie Evans is with Chris. Chris Jenner?
Chris Humphries? Right?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. Exactly.
Yeah.
So coming back, let's dig in a little bit, I think, on speaking of, you know, deficiencies and speaking of rebounding, I guess. Let's talk about the defense, Brett. I don't know if you've heard it mentioned at all. The Nets, not a defensive master team. So, you know, the joke where people say, why don't they just make the entire plane out of the black box since the black box can survive the accident? Well, Brett, why don't the Nets make their entire defense out of Nick Claxton? Because, like, if you look at his individual defensive metrics, and this was shouted out on the low post and then aggregated by Alex Sturm on Nets Twitter, his individual defensive metrics are bonkers. When he is the closest defender, he is holding his defendee. Is that the right word? Someone who is being defended by him.
Defendants.
He is holding them. He is holding them to 33.7% from the field, which is the best in the league. And you know, not like going hand in hand with that, you know, he causes the greatest dip in opponents' field goal percentage. So in terms of what you would expect that player to shoot, what they do shoot, based on the tracking data, it is -12.5% for Claxton, which is best in the league.
Wow.
The team. So I mean, that's pretty insane, right? The team numbers of the Claxton on the floor are even more ridiculous. You know, for a team that is middle of the pack at best in defensive rating overall, they have a 104.44 defensive rating when he is on the floor. And that is 2 points better than the Lakers league leading 106.8. So if they're literally, in the minutes that he has played, they're the best team in the league. Like, why? I mean, I guess I'll pitch you the question in two ways. How much do you think he's going to play in the playoffs? And maybe part of that is, why do you think he hasn't played more? And do you think that'll change?
Okay. I've thought about this a bit. Do you recall on a previous podcast when we spoke about the Jeff Green at center lineup as the Nets' best closing lineup, or so we thought at the time, and pontificated that this was the Nets' version of Steve Nash and the coaching staff being the older brother sitting up in his chair while the little brother starts beating him at video games meme?
Yes. Yes, I do.
We may have been wrong in the way that we were thinking about that. One, in that Jeff Green may have now been replaced by Blake Griffin, and that's something that we'll get into later. But two, we probably should have split that off into an offensive and a defensive closing lineup, or an offensive or a defensive version of that meme. And I think that Nicholas Claxton's minutes become the defensive version of that meme. So, for example, to answer the specific questions that you threw out there, how much do you think he'll play in the playoffs? And why hasn't he played more? For the first part of that, I think he'll play more and more as we get deeper into the playoffs and the going gets tough. I could see his minutes being fairly low in this Celtics series to get other players going. And because, quite frankly, we may not need to use him as our break glass in case of emergency, go out there, muck things up, and turn the Nets' average defense into a great defense for a stretch of 5 to 6 minutes. Now, why hasn't he played more? Oh, and also switching defense becomes more and more important the deeper you get into the playoffs, because you come across more and more complex offenses with less and less holes. And it becomes about how can you cover all things all the time instead of specific schemes to take away one or two players. Now, why hasn't he played more? I think this is a fairly complex answer. The first of which comes down to his injury history. In both his first and second season, I wouldn't call them significant injuries, but he's had injuries where he's had to miss a significant amount of extended time. So coming back from those injuries, you limit somebody's minutes. He isn't used to playing with the team. He has to reintegrate himself with the other players. You don't want to just throw him out there and play him 48 minutes a game. Plus, he's gone through health and safety protocols a few times. There's just been a bunch of bumps in the road that haven't led him up to a point where he's played enough games, shown enough value that Steve Nash couldn't help but play him big minutes without feeling like he was sacrificing some continuity and also potentially negatively affecting Nick Claxton's ramp up time back from being healthy or testing out the previous injuries that he's had and maybe going overboard with that. Now, the second piece of that is it's his second year. He's on a team chock full of veterans. And before it was just DeAndre Jordan and Blake Griffin and Jeff Green and hell, Bruce Brown as his center competition. He also had LaMarcus Aldridge in there. So there was the pecking order component of that as well. And I just think that there's the typical, hey, you're a second year player. You have to earn your keep and we're going to put you out there when we can. And we're going to take you out of the game when we don't feel like we can totally rely on you to make all of the right decisions at one time. So that's how I'm thinking about that. But I do think that it would be ridiculous if the Nets coaching staff didn't realize that Nick Claxton gave us our best shot to have a competent defense when we need it. And when we do need it, if he's not out there, I think those are the moments that are really going to light Nets Twitter and Nets fans ablaze, because those are the moments that are really going to uncover how quote unquote competent this particular coaching staff is on both the offensive and defensive end. So when the going gets tough, we'll find out what players the Nets really value in the postseason. And I would be incredibly surprised if when we got to a moment where we needed to call upon our defense, Nick Claxton wasn't out there and playing big minutes and there was no complexity surrounding taking minutes away from grizzled veterans who have put in their time, or Nick Claxton being a second year player, or Nick Claxton having injury concerns, because it's win or go home time. And that's the way I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think a couple things I'll respond to. I don't necessarily know. So I agree broadly with what you said. I don't necessarily know if it's a question of the coaching staff's competence as much as it's maybe a question of philosophy. So just looking at his like game logs, first of all, I think, you know, part of it is just a very simple explanation of, you know, he missed most of the first half of the season. You know, he came back in late February, you know, worked his way up from about 12 or so minutes a game to, you know, playing around 20 by the March 17th game against Indiana. That was the first game that he closed. He pretty steadily played in the 20s from there until LaMarcus Aldridge showed up, and that kind of dipped his minutes back down as they were trying to get him back involved. He had gotten back up to you know, that like sort of 22, 23 minutes a game through the Miami game. Contracted COVID at that point, missed, you know, a bunch more games, and, you know, was a slow kind of ramp up coming out in Milwaukee and Dallas, and against Denver before, you know, really hitting the ground running in that Chicago game. So a little bit, I think, is just circumstance. I do feel like, you know, and I do think to your point, like if you look at that Denver game and the comeback that they had in those late possessions against Nikola Jokic, like Claxton was going out for those to guard Jokic down the stretch when they knew they needed to stop. So I do think that there's some recognition there of what he brings on that end of the floor. One of the questions that I have about this is philosophical. So he, like, just looking at kind of his on-off stats overall, the biggest gains that they get from him, in addition to just defensive rating, are a huge bump in second chance efficiency, 10% bumps in offensive and defensive rebounding, which I think are pretty material, and contributes to that defensive efficiency, a bump in free throw attempt per 100 possessions. But they're slightly worse shooting the ball, right? Decrease, a little bit of a decrease in turnovers, slightly worse true shooting, slightly worse effective field goal percentage, which totally makes sense, right? And I think if you look at the individual shooting splits, the mid-range percentages go down when Claxton's on the floor, which makes sense again, because he's a kind of somebody that you're not as worried about on offense. When I look at the offensive rating and tried to sort of control for who is playing center. The Nets are, let me see where I put it. Like, the Nets offensive rating with Claxton on the floor is 118, which is like a little bit below. It's actually kind of close to their overall rating, but when you look at so just looking at the other center possibilities, it's 115.9 with DeAndre Jordan. It is 120.66 with Jeff Green in minutes where Jordan or Claxton are not on the floor. It is 125.14 with Blake Griffin in minutes where DJ or Claxton are not on the floor. So there's a little bit higher of a plane, I think, that they reach offensively with a small ball, like playing five out, with a shooting five in there. Part of my question is, and I don't mean to extrapolate too much from DeAndre Jordan to Nicholas Claxton, but what struck me watching the Bucks game, the second Bucks game, was I actually thought DeAndre Jordan did a pretty good job against Giannis. Certainly did a very good job executing the game plan against Giannis. And I know Giannis had gotten loose for 50 points the game before, but part of that is because the game plan is sort of like, you're going to let him take the shots that he's taking. I thought he held his own defensively. I thought the reason that he got played off the floor was because of what happened on offense. And in particular, I noticed anecdotally the Bucks like able to basically throw an extra defender into doubles or into help defense that could kind of play off of DeAndre Jordan, because you didn't need to recover to contest against DeAndre Jordan. You could recover and foul just as easily. And, you know, Claxton shoots a poor free throw percentage just like Jordan does. I feel like that the hack a center strategy is on the table. And I just wonder if this is a team that is going to win because their offense is going to be so elite. Is there a ceiling that you put on that offense by going with a center who is more of a rim roller, lob finisher type, as opposed to, you know, somebody who can step out and hit a three and handle the ball the way that Jeff Green and Blake Griffin can? And is that trade-off going to be one? Like, obviously you want Claxton in there for his defense. But is that trade-off in terms of preventing you from being able to hit those heights offensively worth the betterment of your defense when you're really going from not great to mediocre? Does that make sense?
It does. It's situational, in my opinion. And you really opened my eyes when you were talking about the Denver game and playing Clax on defensive possessions but pulling him out for offensive possessions. I could see us really picking our spots with Clax. So for example, if we're already behind in the fourth quarter and we need a comeback, I could see that being the time when we go to a Claxton to give us a spark, run amok around the court, and see if us getting stops and having the offense be a little bit less than historically all-time great, that combination could bring us back into the game. But if we're already ahead and we're winning those games, I don't see us going to Claxton. To your point, I see us going with our more traditional lineup that has offense out there to hope that we can score enough to keep the other team at bay, knowing that sacrificing defense in that particular scenario might make a little bit more sense. So I'm trying to think of what teams you could see those scenarios arising the most against. And you could see, similar to what happened in the 76ers game, if we're down against the Sixers, then we suddenly get a 5 to 7 minute stretch of Nick Claxton, and maybe even throw some of our other spark plugs out there like Alize Johnson or Bruce Brown to see if they can muck things up and get us back in the game. But if we're talking about closing out a game outside of having enough timeouts left to play offense defense, I think you're right that he won't be in there on key offensive possessions down the stretch, unless we're staging a big comeback.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I, to be clear, like, I don't think he's a liability on offense at all. Like, no. I think he's a positive offensively. Like, I think he has more roll gravity than DeAndre Jordan. I don't think that you could necessarily keep that same strategy with him just because he can move a little bit better and he can finish a little bit better, even if he can't shoot free throws. So I don't mean to disparage him in that way, but I do just think more in terms of the philosophy and more in terms of the conversation that we had a couple episodes ago where we were like, okay, gun to your head, cards on the table, like what is Steve Nash going to revert to? And I think it's going to be beautiful offensive basketball more so than anything else. But to your point, I think he solves a little bit the problem of like, if the Nets are down six, when the starters come back in the fourth quarter, like unless the other team misses shots, I feel like this is a team that will have a tough time coming back from that. Like, because their sort of want is to trade buckets. So he can help there. The only other thing I would just note, just cause it's kind of fun, is like defensively, he should, and he has good numbers with Harden, but not necessarily amazing ones. Like he seems like just is such a perfect fit for Harden because, mm-hmm. you know that Harden wants to switch everything. You know that Harden is like a guard who excels at sort of guarding bigs, and Claxton is sort of a big that excels at guarding smalls. So the fact that they should be able to switch there and guard each other's guy seems like it should work. Perfectly. And a stat to that effect is that Harden is in the 99th percentile guarding the roll man on pick and rolls, and Claxton is in the upper 2/3, 67th percentile guarding the ball handler on pick and rolls. So kind of just like a natural synergy there. And somebody on Twitter threw out just the idea of like a quote unquote bench lineup that would be Harden, Claxton, flanked by like Jeff Green, Landry Shamet, and Joe Harris. And that I think is definitely a situation that I could see them, playing where you give Harden the ability to create and be a little bit heliocentric with an excellent role man in Claxton, somebody who can anchor the defense, and then just knock down shooters in, everywhere else. So that's a fun look that hopefully we'll see a little bit of.
I'm trying to separate my own personal bias for wanting to watch as many James Harden, Nicholas Claxton possessions as possible to when does it really make sense. And hell, think about all of those games that we won where we forced James Harden to be out there with two centers. Effectively, if you want to count Bruce Brown as a center, him and DeAndre Jordan playing hot potato 5 feet from each other in the paint, and Harden was able to win those games. Imagine what he could do with that lineup that you just threw out there. Oh, man, it's going to be so much more fun than we're thinking. And I just hope that this first round series allows us to really work out those kinks and find a couple extra wrinkles. And I'd sacrifice a few games if we could just experiment a little bit with the big three out there and figure some stuff out like that.
I like it. I like it. Yeah. I like that you threw out wrinkles and kinks. The wrinkle kink.
The old kinkles.
The gilfs.
Those related to kinkles. Not quite sure.
Kinkle, I got a kink for cankles. What are you taking away?
Probably time to switch to our next topic here. But I am, I'm always perusing sites out there, and in a video that I saw that I found a little bit interesting, and I think it's a topic of conversation worth broaching, was the Ringer's Rajah Bell and Logan Murdoch did a short take on whether or not the Nets title hopes were fake or real a week ago. And hey, it's no surprise to anybody that's watched this team or anybody that has never even watched a game of basketball and just looked at it on paper that the Nets were deemed real contenders by a former NBA player and a great NBA analyst. But what really caught my attention was the side conversation about the Nets towards the end of the video, where Logan and Rajah were asking each other to list the most important Nets role player headed into the postseason. And Rajah said, "Your boy, our boy, uncle, dunkle, Jeffrey Green," as his most important role player for the Nets. And Logan went with the maybe more popular, or at least higher brand name pick of Blake Griffin. And so that just got me thinking, and I wanted to ask you about this, Carl. Who would you say, in your opinion, is the most important Nets role player headed into the postseason?
So we talked about this a couple weeks ago, and I said Jeff Green. I think now it probably is Blake Griffin. Like I just think they're really kind of counting on him for minutes, just because I think he brings a little bit more defensively in terms of his ability to guard the post. Like in some ways, I think that he's a little bit more suited for that small ball five role than Green is. Like when you talk about like actually having to match up against like Green, I think is good in the small ball five role if you're playing the other team's big off the floor. If the other team's going to keep their big on the floor, then I think you want Blake in there. And he's kind of your best bet, just with his ability to, you know, hold his own down low, take charges, you know, and make things happen. And then I think he adds a beautiful element on offense. I mean, he's been shooting like a really high percentage of his threes. I think he's over 40 in the time that he's been with the Nets. So that's, you know, been a huge positive. I don't know 100% how sustainable it is. And I know he doesn't take that many attempts, but what he brings from a passing perspective, I think really adds a fun additional layer. When you talk about him kind of creating off the short roll and, you know, when the offense ends up with the center getting the ball out front, it's pretty cool to see what he can do. So I would say Griffin is probably the most important, only because, or I guess for two reasons. One, because he's brought more than I think we thought he would, but also, and maybe more importantly, because that is a real area of deficiency that the Nets have in terms of like wanting to play small and needing somebody to be a small ball five that's able to match up with bigs. And he's their best chance to do that.
He seems to look healthier, spryer, younger every single game that he plays with the Nets. And I don't know if that's a byproduct of him getting more comfortable with the team, or it really is him getting healthier by working with our performance staff and our coaching staff. But we went from, hey, it's really fun to have Blake on the team, and it's great that he's buying in and really sacrificing, to, man, this guy is making a real impact, and he's now probably going to be part of our closing lineup, because it's tough to see him not being on the floor when the game and the possession and every second matters most to the Nets. So I think it's been really cool to see him go from this dude is washed on the Pistons to getting traded to the Nets, to everybody saying, oh, the league is over, to him not playing that great, to everybody celebrating him dunking for what seemed like the first time in 5 years, to now him throwing spinning behind the back passes and being part of one of the top five highlights of the NBA season, and us now believing that he's an integral part of the Nets closing lineup. So that has been a very fun journey. I'm on board for the Blake Griffin experience, and those of you on the bandwagon should be as well.
Do you think anybody outside of the two of them should merit consideration?
I have some honorable mentions for sure. I think that, and well, first of all, I do think that Claxton would merit consideration. Also, I'm not including Joe Harris as a role player. He's a sub-all-star. As noted in Ben Taylor's podcast, I still cannot believe that in a sub-all-star podcast, he replaced Joe Harris with Nicholas Batum on his sub-all-star team. Come on, man. Nicholas Batum, the dude was doing nothing in Charlotte for the past 4 to 5 years. He comes in, he doesn't have to do anything on this Clippers team. He can just kind of sit in the corner, pass the ball around a few times. Those guys are going to make shots. The best jump shooting team in the NBA. Of course, he's going to get assists. Nobody cares about
him. He got absolutely roasted possession after possession in the first Lakers Nets game at Barclays, which like I didn't 100% notice in real time. And that was like one of the games that I went back and charted. And it was just every single time one of the big three just picked him out and just scored in his face. It was great. Anyway, continue.
But that was angry. That's why we're not talking about Joe Harris. We are not overlooking the one of the greatest Nets of all time, and I don't say that lightly. Clax, we've talked about him enough, but he's really the only true great defender that the Nets have, and really the only player who has a big enough team defense impact to turn the Nets team defense into a decent defense. But we've talked about him enough. The other honorable mention that I'd throw out there, there's two more. One, Landry Shamet. Now, I don't think he's going to get this award, but what I'm looking forward to watching in the postseason is I really feel like Shamet could win us multiple playoff games on his own if he gets hot. And I think we'll have a long enough postseason stretch for, by law of averages, he's going to have a couple games where he hits 5+ threes out of nowhere. And that's going to swing a game or could potentially swing a series. And I love having a player like that on the team. And I'm really, really hoping that it comes to fruition, because I want to remember after this postseason, the Landry Shamet game or the Landry Shamet games. Like, please give me one, give me two of those games. I need to see it. And the last person that I'll throw out there, and one thing that I found really interesting, Alize Johnson, is this guy going to get minutes in the postseason? Who knows? But he does lead the Nets in win shares per 48 minutes, which is wild. He's above James Harden. He's above Kevin Durant. He's above Kyrie Irving. Dude plays hard. He gives us a little bit of a wrinkle. I don't think teams will really know what to do when he's out there. That being said, he's a dude that goes 100 miles per hour every possession. Guess what all the teams and all the players and all the teams are doing in the playoffs? They're going 100 miles per hour on every possession. And that could also be a potential knock against somebody like a Claxton too, where that dude's young. He's going out there. He's trying his absolute hardest every possession that he plays. That can be an advantage in a regular season when a lot of teams are just trying not to get injured. In the postseason, when it's win or go home and teams are all ratcheting up, we'll see if he remains as effective. I think it's a much bigger risk for a guy like Alize Johnson, but I did want to call that out because even though he's an unconventional player, I think that he's really moved the needle in some of the Nets comebacks, and he's been a really fun guy to watch.
So before your Alize Johnson curveball, I was going to make fun of you for basically just saying, oh, I have some honorable mentions. Here's every other role player on the team. But Cut. The disrespect, Brett, for you to not mention Bruce Brown, I think, is just wow. I'm going to throw him out there. Like, he's had an interesting year in the sense that, I think he is very, very contextually dependent in terms of his ability to really, get loose in a game. But I think it's less like what we've like less that the Nets will need what we've seen from him as like the Biggie Smalls, 6'4" center, and more just like if he's able to play as like a big rebounding guard, frankly, like I think that will be very, very welcome on this team. So if you slotted him in for Harris, whether you consider him to be sort of the two guard with like Harden as a point forward and Kyrie, or, maybe he's out there when Kyrie's getting a rest, alongside, Harden and Griffin and Green and Durant, like I think his ability to come in, be a little bit physical, is something that I could see the Nets needing. Like it's a shot in the arm that I could see the Nets needing a lot. So I think there'll probably be games and maybe even series where he really doesn't play a lot, but I think he's a good break glass in case of emergency, or not even in case of emergency, just like, we need to, he's the 2 p.m. coffee of this Nets lineup. And you may pay for it later, but sometimes you absolutely need it and he'll get you through the rest of your day.
Like, man, did you crush that 4 p.m. meeting, but now it's 2 a.m. and you're on season 2 of Attack on Titan.
Yeah, or, you tried to go to bed, but instead you watched the end of the Kings comeback like I did that other year.
Hey, worth it.
So we do want to make some picks here, but before we do that, I guess my last question is, this is something I've mentioned a lot before. It's something that I have heard sort of bandied about a couple different places. They talked about it on the Low Post with Jeff Van Gundy, referencing an article by Brian Windhorst just on like, does defense matter anymore in the NBA generally? And I think Brooklyn has become kind of the avatar for like, has the pendulum swung too far back toward offense? And I contrast them with the 04 Pistons just as sort of like the avatar of the pendulum swinging too far toward defense previously. We all know the cliche that defense wins championships. Does what the Nets represent in terms of being a team that's going to win with their offense and hopefully their defense will be good enough to remain along for the ride, does that break basketball, I guess, is one way to look at it. And like, is that a viable, like, do you feel like the Nets have a viable chance to do that? Or is it one of these situations where, yeah, that's their reputation, but actually their defense is going to have to be really, really good?
I think that's a really tough question to answer. And I I've been going back and forth on how I think about it. I think if this does become a blueprint for what the NBA is going to look like in the future. I don't necessarily know if it's going to have immediate changes, but I could see this ending the importance of defense or having teams put a lot more focus on offense and just hoping that they can figure defense out enough with effort in the postseason as more and more talent gets injected into the league. And you can then have teams not necessarily as talented as the Nets, because I think that the Nets might not be one of a kind, but they're one of a very, very, very few number of teams that will ever have this level of passing, this level of scoring, this level of playmaking, this level of talent all on one team at these ages versus guys that are on their absolute last legs just trying to make it work or latch onto a couple young stars and hope that they can ride them to a championship. So you could see that in the future, as these players are getting more and more skilled. I mean, hell, we're having guys that are over 7 feet coming into the league that can already run the point, pass and shoot. And that seems to be getting more and more. But it's tough for me to look at this and think, oh, okay, the rest of the league is going to look at the Nets and say, well, we need to invest in offense because look at what they did. Yeah, let's get Giannis and let's see if Kawhi will come to Milwaukee and who else do we want? Who's a good young star? Could we get Zion there? Like, it's just very tough to see that happening again. It almost seems like a Warriors type of event where everything just works out perfectly and they're able to make it happen. And it's tough to see another team having players that have these type of relationships, these type of circumstances, this type of front office all come together at once and be at the same stage in their career and the same point of the career where they're all wanting to sacrifice like this at once to create a team like the Nets. So I still don't quite know what the answer to your question is, but I think it's no. I do believe that the pendulum has swung back towards offense, but I don't think it's going to be because of the Nets. I think it was already going that way. And I don't think that the Nets are a team that other franchises will view as realistic enough to say that's what we need to go for. But I do think it's interesting that before the Nets have done anything and even made a single postseason run with this team, that other teams at the deadline and on the waiver wire were all reacting to what the Nets built and not to what the defending champions had built and what other teams in the Eastern and Western Conference have built. It was all, okay, cool. Let's get a PJ Tucker. Let's pick up a George Hill. Let's pick up an Andre Drummond, all players that might be able to slow or mess with what the Nets have built in Brooklyn. So very convoluted answer, but that's how I was thinking about it.
Yeah, I think it's multifaceted as well. The reason that I like this question is that it touches on one of my main theories of sports and analytics in sports, which is that things that become common wisdom and things that become cliches are often things that are said disproportionately by coaches and told disproportionately to players throughout their careers that aren't necessarily properly valued in terms of like what their impact is on the game. And I think preaching buy-in on defense is an example of something where it is necessary. I don't think the Nets can win without buying in on defense, but I think the way in which that is said creates the perception that defense is more important than offense, which is not true. I just think that it requires more motivation. It requires more coaching. It requires more buy-in for a player to engage on that end typically than it does for them to engage on offense. And I feel like it's kind of a silly example, but we talked about this, you know, my joke before about like Kevin Durant not understanding why, you know, playing for the Warriors is viewed as taking the easy way out when it was probably harder for him to play on that team because of what they needed from him on the defensive end than it was, you know, to play in Oklahoma City. And, you know, he can't control like what's happening outside of his team. And so even though any sort of rational thinking person would look at who he's teaming up with and what that means in terms of his chances to play in a championship and be like, yeah, that's a much easier path. But I think the amount of buy-in that it required from him, you know, does probably makes it feel harder to him in a lot of ways. So I think there's a little bit of a disproportionate piece there. And I think the other thing is when I hear a lot of analysis of the Nets defense, like including that Rajah Bell, Logan Murdoch video, and not to disagree with those guys, because obviously Rajah Bell's probably forgotten more about basketball than I will ever know. But like, I do think that we struggle to like defense more than offense is a really a team concept. And we struggle, I think, sometimes to understand like what makes a good team defense and what doesn't, because we just look at it as a collection of players. And I think it's easy to sort of like look up and down. I mean, like even if you use the Knicks this year as an example, like to give them credit for everything that they've done, like part of what's so incredible about, you know, their defensive success is it's not like you look up. I mean, Nerlens Noel is really, really good. And I think underrated from a defensive standpoint. But if you look up and down the rest of that roster, like they have players that are good players, and I don't mean to sandbag them at all, but it's not like they're winning with guys that you would have thought at the beginning of the year, like, oh, these are just excellent defensive players. And it's not even necessarily like they're winning with guys that if you took them off that team and put them on a different team, it's like, oh, that improves their defense a ton. Like at some point, and I felt this way with the Nets sort of all season, like if you're going to have the big three that you do, your success defensively is going to be on how those three guys buy in. You can surround them with whatever role players that you want. I mean, unless it's Giannis and Anthony Davis, like as your back line, like you're going to need those three guys to buy in and step up, which I think that they're all capable of. And I think that they're all good at. So I think to a certain extent, we undersell it because this team is not really built of guys that are necessarily known for their defense. But I think we've seen multiple lengthy stretches from this group that would suggest that they can be good enough. So I don't think it's that defense doesn't matter. I think that's the wrong way to look at it. I don't think it's that offense, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I wish people would look at the way that we evaluate things and not put so much stock in, you know, reputation of guys, particularly guys that are known typically for their offense when we sort of know that we have a hard time quantifying defense anyway. And I think the last thing with this group too is, you know, we've seen, like it hasn't been entirely linear, but we've seen a fair degree of improvement with this team, you know, over the course of this season in terms of like, if you think back to some of those early games where, you know, they just clearly hadn't figured the system out yet. You know, we've seen them get a lot more comfortable even as they're missing guys and even as they're having tough games. So I think there's reason to believe that I think defense is important. And I think that there's reason to believe that they're not as bad as they've, you know, been purported to be.
Yeah. I think that's fair to say you're saying, because the key Nets players, the ones that are going to get the most amount of minutes on the team and the ones that are going to have to put the most amount of effort into defense to affect our defensive rating and raise that floor are the guys that you probably don't want putting that type of effort in during the regular season. You want them to pick their spots and you want them to be completely healthy going into the postseason, i.e. our big three. And you want them to then, quote unquote, like you said, figure it out or have the energy and have the health to be able to put it together for just enough stretches in just enough games to win a championship. And I do think that we are poised and in a position to do that, but it does come down to a certain level of belief that that is what the team is doing. They do have another level to get to, even if that level isn't one of the best defenses in the league. So case in point, I definitely see that. And you could see the team's most poised to win a championship no longer caring about defense in the regular season, but more using the regular season to prepare to play the type of defense they know they're going to need in the postseason to win a championship. And that could be what's changing about the league, if that hasn't already been a change that's happened, where, hey, great, you've got these try-hard teams that have really upped their regular season point differential, and they won 10 more games this year than they did last year. But when they get to the postseason, they don't get past the first round, because then every team is trying really hard. The best teams are the teams that are the exact opposite of that, and that's probably a trend that's going to continue to get more accentuated and more extreme, especially if the Nets go on a run. And that's what I could really see the Nets affecting.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I think to a certain extent too, like the degree, you know, I keep coming back to something that I heard in a Ben Taylor podcast from a couple of years ago, just which is that, you know, we break the game down into these phases. We talk about offense and defense as if they're two separate things, and they are in fact, you know, two separate skills or they're more than two skills. They're, you know, made up of different skills on either side of the ball. But ultimately at the end of the day, like, you know, players don't usually get pulled off for their offense or their defense. Teams don't usually succeed because of one or the other. Like, you're playing both at all times. And so I think the degree to which, you know, being a team that shoots as well as the Nets does offensively, mm-hmm. being a team that's, you know, so difficult to guard and has to run, you know, such little action on offense and really like work less hard for their baskets, like that impacts defense, I think, in a lot of ways, and particularly in games where, you know, they are putting up so many points so quickly. Like, you know, I think there's an impact there as well that's a little bit unseen and a little bit difficult to quantify. So I don't necessarily, you know, like I said, like I think it's really more of a question about the Nets being sort of the figurehead for sort of other changes that are happening in the league, as opposed to, you know, really meaning one way or the other about the team. I think it's an interesting angle. You know, we'll see what happens. But I don't think that they win without buying in on defense. But I also feel like they can buy in on defense, win, and people will still think they only won because their offense is just so good. So we'll see what happens, I guess, to a certain extent.
Agreed. I hope their defense is good enough that folks start to notice it, but you're probably right.
Should we make
some
picks?
Always be outshined by the offense. Let's make some picks.
I think you're on mute.
Really?
Oh, now you're back.
Oh, weird. Oh, well, anyway, what I just said was I'm hoping that in the postseason, the defense gets to a point where folks start to notice it and it outshines the offense even for one moment or two moments, but I doubt that's going to happen, and you're probably right, and I agree with you. It's time to make some picks. So,
all right, how do we want to roll this out here?
So are we just going to pick this first round series and how many games?
Yeah, let's do that. I mean, we could pick the other ones too, maybe, but
yeah, let's pick this one and how many games, and take it one step at a time. Cool. I'll probably be eating these words. Do you want me to start?
Yeah, please.
All right. You know, I'll probably be eating these words, but you know, I did say some fairly kind things about Jason Tatum and Brad Stevens to kick off the podcast about 7 hours ago. So I do feel like this series is going to be Nets in five, not Nets in a sweep. It is very tough for me to see when you look at talent level and personnel and matchups and how both teams play the Celtics winning a game. But I think Jason Tatum's a future league MVP. I think this is a team with characters like Kemba Walker, Tristan Thompson, Marcus Smart that is going to get scrappy and it's not going to get broken mentally. And they have a coach who's been there before and has put together good schemes. And I think that that'll be enough for them to eke out one game. And quite frankly, I'm hoping that they do, because I think it'll be good for this team to lose a game in the first round and have to make some adjustments.
Yeah. I was going to say Nets in five as well. I think just like this also isn't a team that's necessarily known for being super consistent in terms of their effort night to night. So I do think like it could be a scenario where I could even see it be sort of like Nets in six, but like the series never feels in doubt because, you know, maybe you go up 3-0 and then drop 2-1 and 3-1 and then drop another one, like, because they're just not hyper focused. But I do think when the chips are down, like this team will win, and I don't think it'll be a particularly difficult series. So I'm going to say Nets in five as well.
All right. Johnny Five is alive.
Absolutely. Five Alive. My favorite drink.
Wow. Is that a real drink?
Yeah. Never had Five Alive?
No. No, all I can think of is Live at Five. Huh. Shout out to Stamford, Connecticut.
It's like a concentrated fruit punch of some kind. It's pretty good. One time Monica made a cocktail with a passion fruit and I said that it tasted like Five Alive and she got very offended. But I was like, I loved Five Alive, so.
That was a compliment.
It's positive. Do we want to pick the other series real quick?
I think we should save that.
Okay. You don't want to pick the other first round series?
Oh, absolutely. Let's pick the other first round series. Let's do that. Okay. Pull them up.
We've got Philly, Washington. We've got Knicks, Hawks. We've got Bucks, Heat in the Eastern Conference in addition to Nets, Celtics. And then in the Western Conference, we've got Utah and either Memphis or Golden State. We've got the Clippers and Mavericks. We've got Denver, Portland, and we've got Phoenix and the Los Angeles Lakers. Lakers opening as a favorite as the 7 seed.
That is so brutal. Imagine if you're the Suns. It's terrible. And you work all miserable season to get the 2 seed. You're one game miserable behind the first seed. And your reward is playing the defending champion, Los Angeles Lakers, who have added Dennis Schroeder, Montrezl Harrell. I said like Marv Albert there trying to say his name. And Andre Drummond. It's just brutal. Like, come on.
Anyway. Marc Gasol too, but yeah.
Yeah, but they had Marc Gasol last year. Oh, or did they not? Did they pick him up?
No, they didn't. He was on Toronto.
Yeah, that's brutal. They're screwed.
I mean, he's not good anymore, so it's not that big of a deal, but
he can still pass.
All right, so let's go. Let's rip through these. Knicks, Hawks. Cool.
Knicks, Hawks. Knicks fans are going to kill me. I'm taking the Hawks in 6.
Woo! I'm going to go Knicks in 7.
Love that. Love that. Listen, I believe in Tibbs. I love the Knicks season. We'll see. We'll see. Okay. What about go ahead, sorry.
No, go hit me.
I was gonna say I'm just gonna throw them out there. Let's go rapid fire. How about Blazers Nuggets?
That's the toughest series to predict. I
think so too.
I kinda wanna pick Portland just because Lillard and with the Murray injury, but like damn, like Denver's been playing really, really well down the stretch, and Porter Jr.'s on like a different plane. So I think I'm still going to say Denver.
Man,
in 7.
Jokic is one of my favorite players, not only in the league, but of all time. Just his story, where he came from, how he almost has no holes in his game now, the way it's just like everything about him is so unique and awesome, and he seems like a great guy too. I think the Blazers are going to find a way to win the series. I'm going to go Blazers in 7.
Give me Philly, Washington.
Man, I want to watch more of Russell Westbrook in the postseason. I just like watching that guy play. If he's missing jumpers by 3 feet or grabbing offensive rebounds and putting it back or trying to play defense or at least look like he's playing defense. I want to say Sixers in 6, but I think I'm going to say Sixers in 5.
I think I'm going to say Sixers in 4. I think the Sixers are going to come out on a mission. How about Miami, Milwaukee?
This is a fun series. Man, would I love to see the Heat mess with the Bucks again. But that being said, I don't know if I want to see Spoelstra in the second round. So I think I'd go Bucks in 6 in this one. They get past him. PJ Tucker plays his butt off. There you go.
Yeah, I think that's my pick as well.
Bucks Brandon Jennings, 6. Bucks in 6.
let's round out the West, the Western Conference. How about Utah? I guess assume your opponent and then give a pick.
I'll say man. I will say Jazz in. I'll say Jazz in 5. I want to believe in the Jazz over the Grizz.
Okay. I think if it's Memphis, it's Jazz in 4. I think if it's Golden State, it's Jazz in 6.
Word.
I think you just get two ridiculous Curry games. How about Phoenix and the Lakers?
Oh my God. Poor Phoenix. I want to say Lakers in 7 just to give respect to Phoenix, but I think I'm going to say Lakers in 6.
That was my pick as well. Yeah. And then how about the rematch of Lakers or of Clippers Dallas.
That's going to be a fun one. I think that the Clippers are sneakily and under the radar improved. I don't think the series is going past six. I was leaning towards picking it in five, but I think I still have to go Clippers in six. But I think it'll be a much more definitive Clippers in six than it was last year.
That was my exact pick as well. Clippers in six, but I'll give Dallas two games, but I don't really see it going beyond that. I would lean closer to Clippers in five than Clippers in seven.
Fair. So anyway, like our biggest differences were Hawks, Knicks, and Blazers, Nuggets.
I think so. I don't even remember what I picked for Blazers, Nuggets. I picked it two minutes ago.
Picked Nuggets in seven. I had Blazers in seven. And then for Knicks, Hawks, you had Knicks in seven, and I had Hawks.
I had Knicks in seven. You had Hawks in six. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Man.
Pretty good.
I don't know. I just like Trae Young is their biggest hole on defense, and I don't really see too many players in the Knicks that can take advantage of that based on matchups. But maybe I'm thinking about it too simplistically, and I think the Hawks probably have another gear to get to where the Knicks are playing close games, 120 miles per hour every game.
Yeah, I feel like you can bang Trae around enough, and I think the Knicks will be physical and do that. It depends a little bit on how good DeAndre Hunter is coming back. Cause he was so good at the beginning of the season. Like I was legitimately so afraid of him, when he played the Nets. So like, if he's somebody that can like, you know, be a decent foil for Randall, maybe it's a little bit of a different story, but, I don't know. I like what Tibbs is doing. I like it.
Same.
And then I have Philly in four over them in the next round, but
and the next time Vivek comes on the podcast, I'm not allowed based on that pick.
Yeah, definitely. Kick you out. Oh. All right. Assuming that he's, you know, gotten through an hour and 25 minutes of this, which maybe he hasn't, but.
No, all of our listeners have. Come on, Carl.
Of course.
All right.
Well, all right. Woo! You want to do the rundown to wrap us up?
Yeah, round one extravaganza. Man, we had a lot to talk about. We have more to talk about too, but we're at an hour and 25 minutes. Thank you everybody for listening. We appreciate you. We love you. We love being Nets fans. This is so much fun. You can always find us on Spotify, on Breaker, on Stitcher, on Google Podcasts, on whatever podcast, like just Google Podcast Medium. We're probably going to be on there. We get pushed out to all of them, which is great. Look us up on Twitter at Russell and Fro. Email us russellandfro@gmail.com. Address everything to Carl. I don't want to answer your questions. Actually, I do. But unless they're slanderous and about the Knicks, I'm ready for all of those. Outside of that, everybody have a good evening, good morning, good afternoon. I almost pulled the show there.
Bye. They said you murked me by the time I was 21. That shit disturbed me, but you never hurt me. Hello, Brooklyn. If we had a daughter, guess what I'ma call her? Brooklyn Carter. When I left you for Virginia, it didn't offend you. Cause you know I only stepped out to get dinner. Hello, Brooklyn.
How you doing?
That's our back.